This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Happy New Year! On this holiday weekend, when there's maybe a little time to watch a movie, we have an interview about film noir. Here's a scene from the classic 1944 noir, Double Indemnity.
Yes, I killed him. I killed him for money. And for a woman. And I didn't get the money, and I didn't get the woman.
Yeah, that's how a lot of men in film noir end up. They don't get the money, and they don't get the woman. What they do often get is double-crossed and killed. Double Indemnity is one of the films we're going to talk about today with Eddie Muller, who you may know as the host of the Turner Classic Movie Show, Noir Alley, where each Saturday night he screens a film noir. Even if you don't have time to watch the film, his intros are worth tuning in for. Muller has impeccable noir credentials. His book, Dark City, The Lost World of Film Noir, was just published in a new expanded edition. He's the author of a book about the women who starred in these films. He's the founder and president of the Film Noir Foundation, which has restored and preserved more than 30 nearly lost classics in partnership with the UCLA Film and Television Archive. Some of the great film noirs were set in the world of boxing, a world Muller was well acquainted with through his father, also named Eddie Muller, who was considered the West Coast dean of boxing writers and covered boxing for the San Francisco Examiner for over 50 years. He covered his first prize fight in 1926. I interviewed Eddie Muller once before, today's Eddie Muller, not his father, and that was in 1996, after the publication of his book Grindhouse, The Forbidden World of Adults-Only Cinema. Eddie Muller, welcome back to Fresh Air. It is such a treat to have you back on the show.
I am so happy to be here, Terry.
So let's talk about what you mean when you say film noir.
Well, yes, this is one of the reasons it remains so fresh is because it's debatable. Everybody gets to argue about what it is, which really isn't the case with Westerns or musicals or anything. So that's a big part of the appeal, I think. But for me, when I refer to film noir, I'm talking about an organic artistic movement that took place mostly in Hollywood in the mid-20th century. And there's a lot of factors that, go into making something a film noir. They're generally crime stories, and they present a very dark vision of existence, let's say.
How dark? More, please.
I also consider film noir to be sort of the anti-myth. If what Hollywood was always selling was that everything's going to be all right and we're all going to live happily ever after, film noir was the flip side of that coin, saying you really can't trust anybody. The system does not really work for you particularly. You may have to steal to get what you want, just like Fred McMurray says at the top. You know, he wanted that woman and he's going to get the money and he's going to do it through devious means, and these things rarely work out, but man, it sure is fun watching people fail.
And as you've pointed out, most film noir combines like the sinister and the sensual.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons the films remain so popular is because they're very sexy in a way that films aren't sexy today because they were made, you know, during the existence of the production code, and that required a certain amount of restraint by the artists making these films, which is, I think, one of the great pleasures of the movies is how the artists worked around the code and could be suggestive and therefore very sensual when they're making these pictures.
Well, let's hear another clip, and this one also is from Double Indemnity. So just to set it up, Walter Neff, played by Fred McMurray, is an insurance salesman who goes to like a wealthy man's home to remind the man to renew his insurance. The maid lets him in. The man's not home. But Barbara Stanwyck appears at the top of the stairs in a bath towel. And that's it for Walter Neff. Like, he's done. So she puts on some clothes, comes downstairs, and then they talk. Barbara Stanwyck starts first.
Mr. Neff, why don't you drop by tomorrow evening around 8:30? He'll be in then.
Who?
My husband. You were anxious to talk to him, weren't you?
Yeah, I was, but I'm sort of getting over the idea, if you know what I mean.
There's a speed limit in this state, Mr. Neff. 45 miles an hour.
How fast was I going, officer?
I'd say around 90.
Suppose you get down off your motorcycle and give me a ticket.
Suppose I let you off with a warning this time.
Suppose it doesn't take.
Suppose I have to whack you over the knuckles.
Suppose I bust out crying and put my head on your shoulder.
Suppose you try putting it on my husband's shoulder.
That tears it.
Oh, wow. Another hallmark of film noir is like great dialogue.
Yes, you can't do much better than that. And that's Billy Wilder and Raymond Chandler working together to write that. That is a passage that is not in the book by James M. Cain, Double Indemnity. That one was just for the film. And it's a perfect example of what makes these films so special, because you can't really show anything, but you can certainly sling the double entendres as fast and furiously as you can.
You're right that Double Indemnity was the first time a Hollywood film explicitly explored the means, motives, and opportunity of committing murder. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. In the books that these films were based on were largely written in the 1930s and were part of a whole renaissance of hard-boiled crime writing that grew up in the pulp magazines and, you know, Dashiell Hammett and James M. Cain and Chandler and others. And the transition to the movie screen didn't really happen for another 10 years or so. And it was very difficult because of the production code to make movies in which the protagonists were the villains of the piece. And that's really what Double Indemnity did that kicked off the film noir movement. There were other films that you can call film noir before Double Indemnity, but its popularity and being nominated for Oscars and the fact that Barbara Stanwyck, who at that point was the highest paid woman in America, starred in this film, gave it, this imprimatur, if you will, that it's okay now to do this kind of stuff. And Stanwyck was a bit afraid, honestly. She thought that, you know, she'd established herself as this great dramatic actress and a comedian, and that this film might kind of ruin her career, ruin her image. And Billy Wilder said, you know, oh, that's funny. I thought you were an actress. And that was all she had to hear. And she came right on board and gave it her all.
Film noir gave great roles to women in the sense that, you know, they were beautiful, but they were as tough talking as the men. And they often led the men into crimes that would, of course, backfire. And that's the whole idea of the femme fatale. Like, the woman is like seducing the man, leading him into the world of crime, and the man's probably going to get double-crossed by the woman or by somebody else. And there's a scene from the film Crisscross that you describe as the femme fatale manifesto. This is a 1949 film directed by Robert Siodmak. Set up this scene for us.
Well, the premise of this movie is that Burt Lancaster has had his heart broken by Yvonne DiCarlo, and he has left, and we are to imagine that he's, like, traveled around the world. But, of course, he can't get her out of his system, so he returns to Los Angeles. She's now enthralled to this shady character played by Dan Duryea. And then to win her back, there's a whole crime plot and the robbery of an armored car and all this. But you're never quite sure to believe her or not when she says that, yeah, I'm in with you. When it's all said and done, I'll go away with you. You don't really know. And then it all leads to this fateful scene where they're to reunite at this beach house. And I find this scene so compelling because, for once, the woman really gets to express what she thinks about the whole setup. And that's what Yvonne DiCarlo does so beautifully in this scene.
So just to set up the scene, Burt Lancaster was just basically taken out of the hospital against his will by one of the henchmen of the guys who double-crossed him. But Lancaster pays off this guy to just take him to the beach house so he could reunite with Yvonne DiCarlo. And then as we enter the scene, Yvonne DiCarlo is packing up the money, getting ready to leave without him, because he's very vulnerable having just come out of the hospital.
You're going away? You're going to leave me? Here?
How far could I get with you? What kind of a chance would we have? You can't move. You couldn't last a day. Don't you understand? You need help. Doctors. You could never make it. What do you want me to do? Let him get us both? Would that make you feel happier? Does that make sense to you?
No. Not anymore.
Why did you have to come here in the first place? Why? Why? It was all working out. Everything was fine. Paper said you'd be in the hospital for weeks.
All those things you said to me. You weren't lying. You meant it. I know you meant it. You loved me.
Love, love. You have to watch out for yourself. That's the way it is. I'm sorry. What do you want me to do? Throw away all this money? You always have to do what's best for yourself. That's the trouble with you. It always was from the beginning. You just don't know what kind of a world it is.
Okay, take that. So what makes that the manifesto?
I always say in film noir, men and women were equal. They were equally tempted, equally compromised, and equally guilty. It may not be the way you want to be equal, but in that world, that's kind of how it worked out. And so I've always loved that scene because really, you can look at these films from different perspectives. And although so many people think that she's being horrible to him, she's really stuck between these two men who are trying to completely dominate her, and she sees her own way out by taking the money that they plotted to steal and then just running away and getting away from the both of them.
One of the things that Turner did recently was a series called Reframed, in which you and several other of the Turner hosts revisited some classic films and reexamined them, acknowledging how racism and sexism in the films make them problematic, but instead of canceling the films, creating a dialogue around them so we could still watch the films, appreciate what's good about them, and talk about what, like, is really not good. So what was that series like for you? And did it force you to, like, rethink things about certain films? Or had you already gone through that process?
It was good. It was good, I think, for all the hosts to go through that. It was a very interesting exercise. I certainly got a lot out of it, because it's important to revisit these things and think of them in a slightly different way. I'm the oldest host at TCM, and so a lot of these films, you know, I grew up with. I mean, I remember seeing The Searchers when I was, you know, like 14 years old or something, and I certainly didn't see the things in it that I see in it now. And to me, that's completely fascinating. Like, yeah, the world changes, and if movies are going to remain a big part of the cultural discourse, we need to find a way to keep them relevant. So I was really excited about that series, and it certainly got a conversation going on social media.
One of the films I think you talked about was The Searchers. So what did you point out in that film that you hadn't noticed when you first saw it when you were, what, 14, did you say?
Yes. When you're 14 years old and it's 19, whatever, 74 or something, when I saw that, or 1972, when I saw that movie, you know, it's a cowboy and Indians movie. And now you don't really want to say that, right? And a lot of people that I know loved that character of Ethan Edwards and have named their sons Ethan in honor of that character. And I think you really have to look twice and say, you know, it's a study of a character like that who has to overcome his ingrained racism, which is not really the way I think a lot of people saw that movie back in the day. I don't know that they thought that was the point of the movie. And now I watch the movie and I realize that, you know, the door closes on Ethan at the end of the movie and he's left out of the family unit because, you know, he's the mercenary that has to be used to accomplish the mission, but he doesn't get to be really part of the community at the end. That's a heavy concept, you know, and I don't know how many people were getting that, you know, back in the 60s and 70s.
How old were you when you started becoming really absorbed in film noir?
I think I was probably in my early teens, I would say.
Do you think you gravitated to these films because you already had a dark sensibility, or do you think you have a dark sensibility because of these films? I'm guessing you already had a dark sensibility.
I will say this about why I think I was drawn to that world. I do think it had a lot to do with my father, who was a wonderful, wonderful person. And I learned so much about his ability to navigate the treachery of the business he was in, because, you know, he was around boxing and he was around gangsters and all of this stuff. You know, I got a real insider's view of that, and he never let it color him as a person or especially as a father. He was a really kind, generous person. But I do believe I was drawn to the movies because they felt like his world. And I was born pretty late in his life. And, you know, I was a child of the 60s, and I was drawn to that 40s world. And I do believe it's because I never really saw my father in his prime. You know, he was a little past his prime when I was of age. And so it was really something to watch these movies and say, oh, that's the world that he thrived in. And that's exactly what it felt like to me.
Did you watch classic boxing noirs like The Harder They Fall or Body and Soul with your father?
It was very, very difficult because seeing as my father was a boxing expert, he mercilessly picked apart the boxing itself in the films. And as you know, in movies, everything has to be exaggerated for the effect, so that people who do not really understand boxing to begin with feel the drama. You know, like in Raging Bull, any one of the punches thrown in Raging Bull would kill a normal human being. But there's just dozens and dozens of them, you know, and an avalanche of them in that film. And that would always bother my dad, who I remember seeing Raging Bull with him, and he literally out loud in the theater said, "For God's sake, stop the fight." And I'm thinking of these things, you know, my nascent cinephile being, you know, and I'm like thinking of how they told the story and why they did this or that. And then I'd hear my dad in the other room on the phone with some crony of his just complaining about how fraudulent the boxing scenes were. And, oh my God, Joe, you should have seen it. The first punch the guy threw would have killed him, you know? And it's like, oh my God.
In most of these boxing movies, there's corruption. And I'm wondering if your father told you stories about corruption in the real boxing world.
You know, it's interesting. He really didn't. I sort of had to suss a lot of that out on my own. And a lot of that came after my dad died, because then I've written a novel, The Distance, in which my father is basically the central character. And in researching that book, I did interview and talk to a lot of his cronies. And honestly, when my dad died, I so missed these guys, and they missed him, that I was sort of accepted into the fraternity as his substitute. Like, hey, it's Eddie's kid, you know, Eddie's kid, you know. And I learned a lot more that way. And at that point, I was old enough to ask tough questions that I wouldn't have asked when I was a teenager or something, you know. And a lot of guys were very defensive about it, you know, like who was paid to throw a fight, or if somebody was actually owned by a gangster or something. You know, I learned that. It's all there. Then I found my dad's stash of, you know, all the transcripts from the congressional hearings into organized crime's influence on boxing, volumes of which I still have on my bookshelf today. So
I didn't even know there were such hearings.
Oh, my goodness, yes. You know, the early 1950s, it was everything. There were congressional hearings into the communist influence, you know, congressional hearings into the influence of comic books on the juvenile delinquency of America, organized crime's influence on boxing. It was a lot of it was grandstanding by politicians. So much has changed,
heard of that,
right, Terry?
Yeah.
But it was good TV too. That was a big part of it. It was like early television, and so it was very exciting for the networks to put this stuff on TV, because it was America's first chance to see what actual gangsters looked like. You know, Frankie Carbo and Frank Costello, and these guys were like on camera. They were names that people did not know about back then.
Well, I'd like to close with some music, because the music is such a great part of film noir. Some of the scores are just terrific. And like Miklos Roja did some really great ones, including Double Indemnity. And this is a score I particularly like because it has that kind of, the drum is like a pounding heartbeat, like somewhere between a pounding anxious heartbeat and a death march. And it's like the musical version of dread and doom. Do you want to say a few words about the music in film noir and its importance?
Well, I'm very glad that you're singling out Miklos Rozsa, because he is, to me, the best composer of noir. He, you know, Double Indemnity, The Killers, Crisscross, all they're fabulous scores. I think what's interesting about people's impressions of noir is a lot of people have developed a mistaken idea that the scores of these films are jazzy, that there's a lot of brass to them, which is actually something that didn't come in until the 1950s, and it was mostly on television and television theme songs, like Count Basie's theme for M Squad and Henry Mancini's Peter Gunn theme and all that. But in the 40s, they were orchestral scores and very, very European influenced, you know, Max Steiner and Franz Waxman and Miklos Rozsa, as you say, and they're fabulous. I confess I didn't appreciate them as much when I was younger as I do today. Having heard so much of it now, it's like music I'll just play.
Okay, so we're going to close with the music from the Miklos Rozsa score for Double Indemnity. And Eddie Miller, it's been so much fun to have you back on the show. Thank you so much for coming.
An absolute pleasure, Terry. Thank you so much for inviting me. And let's not wait another 25 years.
Absolutely. My interview with Eddie Muller was recorded in October 2021. His show, Noir Alley, is on Turner Classic Movies Saturday nights with a rebroadcast Sunday mornings. The new movie, The Tragedy of Macbeth, stars Denzel Washington and Frances McDormand as Shakespeare's famously murderous power couple. It's the first movie that Joel Coen has written and directed without the involvement of his brother and collaborator Ethan. Our film critic Justin Chang has this review.
In The Tragedy of Macbeth, the director Joel Coen slashes away at Shakespeare's text, distilling every scene to its furious essence. At 105 minutes, this is a shorter Macbeth movie than most. The best-known lines are still there, of course. Is this a dagger which I see before me? And all the rest. But the story of Macbeth's murderous rise to power is told with ruthless concentration. The visuals are as stark and stripped down as the text. Coen and his cinematographer, Bruno Delbonnel, evoke the look of older movies, with a spectral black-and-white palette and a nearly square frame. Carter Burwell's score sets an ominous mood, complemented by what sounds like an executioner's drumbeats. It's an immaculate piece of craftsmanship. The very look and feel of the movie casts a spell. At times you might be reminded of Orson Welles' 1948 Macbeth, and also of Akira Kurosawa's masterful 1957 retelling, Throne of Blood. Still, Coen's greatest influence here is Carl Theodor Dreyer, the austere Danish director who peered deep into his character's tormented souls. The tormented souls here are played by Denzel Washington and Frances McDormand, and it's fascinating to watch two of our most famous actors step out of this movie's expressionist shadows. Washington and McDormand are both in their 60s, somewhat older than most actors cast as Macbeth and Lady Macbeth. And so there's an even greater sense of futility to their deadly plot against the king, Duncan, while he's a guest in their home. This Macbeth's reign of terror is destined to be short-lived. Not much else has changed. Macbeth does the awful deed and seizes power, setting in motion a brutal chain of violence. At one point, he turns to the three old witches, who first prophesied that he would become king. All three witches are played by the English stage actor Catherine Hunter, whose brilliant performance, with its spooky intonations and contortionist gestures, give this movie its darkest magic.
Answer me to what I ask you.
Speak, demand. We'll answer.
Save that straw to hear it from our mouths or from our masters.
Call him. Let me see him.
Double, double, toil and trouble. Fire burn and cauldron bubble.
Double, double, toil and trouble.
Finger of birth strangled babe, ditch delivered by a drab.
Cohen's staging of this sequence is ingenious. Rather than showing us the witches stirring their pot, he positions them up in the rafters like birds, looming over Macbeth, while the floor beneath his feet becomes a bubbling cauldron. Again and again, the director takes some of the most famous moments in the history of the theater and gives them a sense of abstraction. Macbeth's castle looks like something out of a surrealist painting, with its rows of identical archways and bold contrasts of light and dark. As bewitching as the movie looks, the actors are never eclipsed by the production design. McDormand brings her usual steely poise to Lady Macbeth, which makes her unraveling all the more pitiable to behold. And Washington is remarkable. I had feared that this role might call forth a lot of stentorian bellowing, but until all hell breaks loose in the final act, the actor underplays beautifully. Washington plays Macbeth like an old man lost in a fog of his own bloodlust. He murmurs Shakespeare's language as though it really were welling up from someplace deep inside himself. The rest of the superb ensemble combines actors from both stage and screen. Brendan Gleeson plays the doomed, unsuspecting Duncan with a genuinely kingly air, while Bertie Carvel brings the requisite gravity to the role of Banquo, the close friend and battle comrade whom Macbeth will betray. And I loved Corey Hawkins's youthful vitality in the role of Macduff, the rival who will help bring Macbeth's reign to its bloody end. Like the many movies Joel Cohen has made with his brother Ethan, the tragedy of Macbeth has been directed to within an inch of its life, which leeches it of some emotional impact. Sometimes I wanted to linger longer in this dark world, to let its chill seep more fully into my bones. Still, there's no denying Cohen has the right temperament for this doomiest of Shakespeare plays. Add it to the many stories he's told about men lost in tragedies of their own making.
Justin Chang is film critic for the LA Times. He reviewed The Tragedy of Macbeth. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Colson Whitehead's novel Harlem Shuffle is on a bunch of this year's best of lists, including our book critic Maureen Corrigan's list of the best books of the year. We're going to listen to the interview I recorded with him when it was published last September. Whitehead won a Pulitzer Prize for each of his previous two novels, The Underground Railroad and The Nickel Boys. The Underground Railroad is about a 15-year-old enslaved girl who escapes a brutal Georgia plantation. It was adapted into an Amazon TV series. The Nickel Boys was based on the story of the Dozier School for Boys in northern Florida, a reform school infamous for its mistreatment and brutal punishment of the boys who were sent there, and for the buried bodies discovered on its grounds. There's many sides to Colson Whitehead's writing. He also wrote a novel about a plague where everyone who's infected becomes a zombie, and wrote a memoir about playing poker. This year's novel, Harlem Shuffle, is set in Harlem between 1959 and 1964. The main character, Ray Carney, owns a furniture store in 125th Street in Harlem. But he has a sideline trafficking in stolen goods as a fence, or as he prefers to think of it, he was a middleman, part of the natural flow of goods in and out through people's lives from here to there, a churn of property that he helped facilitate. Nothing like his father, who was more of a full-time crook with crooked friends. Ray is also a family man. He and his wife are expecting their second child when the novel begins. The novel is about his dual life, class divisions within Harlem, and the crimes of the elite compared to the crimes on Ray's level. Colson Whitehead, welcome back to Fresh Air. I love this novel. Thanks for writing it, and thanks for coming back to our show.
Yeah, thanks for having me back. It's very exciting.
I want to start by asking you to do a reading. And just to set this up a little bit, so, you know, Ray Carney is a fence, and he basically deals with pretty small-time stuff. But his cousin, who's more of a full-time crook, and this is a cousin who Ray has bailed out all of the cousin's life, the cousin Freddie comes to him and says, look, we're doing a heist of a safe at the Hotel Teresa. And you describe this as the Waldorf of Harlem, and it was a real hotel. And Ray thinks, wow, robbing that is kind of like pissing on the Statue of Liberty. And he thinks this job is just like too big for him. It's like wrong for him. So I'd like you to do a reading about Ray Carney's reaction to his cousin's proposal about fencing the stolen jewels from this heist after the heist is done.
All righty. Even if he were crooked enough for his cousin's proposition, he'd have the contacts to handle a haul from the Hotel Teresa. 300 rooms, who knows how many guests locking up valuables and cash and safe deposit boxes behind reception. He wouldn't know what to do with it. Neither would his man Buxbaum down on Canal have a coronary if Carney walked in with that kind of weight. Carney was only slightly bent when it came to being crooked, in practice and ambition. The odd piece of jewelry, the electronic appliances Freddie and then a few other local characters brought by the store, he could justify. Nothing major. Nothing that attracted undue attention to his store, the front he put out to the world. If he got a thrill out of transforming these ill-gotten goods into legit merchandise, a zap charge in his blood like he'd plugged into a socket, he was in control of it, and not the other way around. Dizzying and powerful as it was. Everyone had secret corners and alleys that no one else saw. What mattered were your major streets and boulevards, the stuff that showed up on other people's maps of you. The thing inside him that gave a yell or tug or shout now and again was not the same thing his father had, that sickness drawing every moment into its service. The sickness Freddie ministered to more and more. Carney had a bent to his personality. How could he not, growing up with a father like that? You had to know your limits as a man and master them.
Thanks for reading that. That's Colson Whitehead reading from his new novel, Harlem Shuffle. So after writing novels with really big social themes, the Underground Railroad and the Nickel Boys, why did you want to write a crime novel set in Harlem in 1959 to 64?
Yeah, well, I usually do mix it up, write a serious book or more sober book and then something lighter with more jokes. I originally was going to follow up the Underground Railroad with Harlem Shuffle, but then after the last election, presidential election, I had to sort out my feelings about being in America. Are we heading in the right direction? Am I optimistic or pessimistic? And so the philosophical dilemma of the two boys and the Nickel Boys was more compelling. But that meant when I finished that book, I had all these notes for Harlem Shuffle, and I was eager to get back to it. As for the why, about 7 years ago, I was trying to think of a movie to rent that night, and I was thinking about how much I like heist movies, and thinking how much fun, you know, the directors and writers must have put it all together. And I asked myself, you know, why can't I do that? And the answer is, no reason at all. Why not?
Now, you said it in a period of the Civil Rights Movement, 59 to 64. It ends a year before the Voting Rights Act. Carney is pretty oblivious to the Civil Rights Movement, but his wife works for a black travel agency that books people into places that are safe for black people, which is especially important in the South. Then the agency becomes involved in booking travel for civil rights groups. And I found it really interesting that the civil rights movement is way in the background for him, whereas it's kind of forefront for her.
Well, I think like many couples, you know, some people, someone is paying attention and the other person isn't. You know, I didn't feel any need to make Carney more political than he probably would be. You know, he's half crook. He's preoccupied with the store and isn't as clued in as the teenagers and college kids who are marching When there are, you know, there are various protests, he hopes that he's not going to get a brick thrown through his window, and that's what he's concerned about. And his cousin Freddie, who's more of a freewheeling type, likes to go to marches so he can talk to pretty girls, you know, these teenagers. So I didn't feel the need to make them more political than they would have been.
So as you've described, the main character has a dual personality. He's part legit businessman with his furniture store. His sideline is as a fence. What interested you in a character with those dual sides?
Well, I always start with, you know, these abstract propositions or questions like, why can't I do a heist novel? And then have to actually make it into a story. So it's a heist. When is it? Where is it? It's going to be in New York. And the first thing I thought was the crooks might exploit some big New York event. So I tried to think of, you know, should I use the blackout of 77? And they use that for cover for a heist. The riot of the early 40s, which was happened when a cop abused a black person in Harlem. And then I thought Ralph Ellison kind of owns that because an Invisible Man. So I can't really go there, which left the riot of 64 after a young black teenager was killed by a white policeman. And so once I had 64, it all flowed from there. I split it up into three sections, 1959, 61, and 64, and tried to find different pegs for what's happening in New York that could serve the story.
So in the book, Ray's father, who is dead when the book begins, he's someone who occasionally had to break somebody's knees. He was the muscle, the guy who had to follow through on the threats. So this is how Ray grew up, with a father who was out all the time doing God knows what. And Ray becomes a fence. Did you have to do a lot of research into how fences operate or how they operated back in the 60s?
Yeah, I mean, and the research is fun because it feeds the book. So I decided to have a fence for a hero because I always find it appalling when I watch a heist movie and, you know, the criminals have stolen their $2 million in jewels and half the gang is dead and the cops are looking for them. And then they go to the fence and the fence says, oh, I'll give you 10 cents on the dollar. It's always so appalling and I'm so mad. And I figured that would be a good person to figure out for a book. And so there's not a lot of literature about fences, but there is actually a book called The Fence, and it's a sociological study about these guys in the Midwest in the 60s. And one of the first things that struck me was their description of being as a wall between the straight world and the crooked world. You know, things come in stolen, slightly previously owned, and then they go out into the world ready for their next owner, cleaned up. And that dividedness I immediately mapped onto to Carney's personality. He has this part of himself that wants to leave the life that he grew up in and have a business and go to college and have a nice family. But there is that call in his blood, which I, you know, sort of put in that reading that we started the show with. And that struggle going back and forth is paralleled by the fence's role and speaks to so much of how I think a lot of us live. You know, I think a lot of us have, you know, different parts of us, reconciled, unreconciled, and sometimes that's the drama of our lives.
I love the way Carney describes some of what he sells as gently used.
he lies to himself. He's not necessarily as clued in to how crooked he is at the start of the book. And in the three different sections, you know, the three different jobs or capers, as I call them. And he gets more comfortable with this criminal side. He rejects it. So at the start of the book, you know, Freddie comes up to him and says, "We're doing this heist," and Carney's like, "That's ridiculous. Like, I'm not a fence. You know, I just a humble businessman, and I sell some lightly used merchandise." And Freddie, of course, calls him on it. And so, part of that internal drama, you know, I have a lot of fun with. How much can Carney admit to himself who he actually is? And then, when he does admit to it, what does he do with that knowledge?
Carney could put what he was doing in a more kind of socio-political economic context and say things like, in a world where my business degree means nothing because I'm black, this is the work I have to do to fulfill my ambitions because doors are closed to me. But he doesn't think in those larger terms. He just thinks like, it's really hard to make a living in a furniture store selling on the installment plan because I barely have the money to pay rent, and I want my family to move to a nicer home. And so I think it's interesting, since you are so socially, politically, economically aware and have written novels that show that in this character's mind, that doesn't really figure into it.
Yeah, well, I think that's what I sort of find lovely about him, is that he's complicated. And as the book goes on and the years pass, he's not hurting as much for money. You know, his wife Elizabeth has a good job and things are going well. But he still does dabble and then do more than dabble in the criminal world. So what drives him? And I think that perplexing situation was very tantalizing. In my last two books, I had an enslaved girl, Cora, who runs north, and she's very much defined by slavery, the social order of the times. And the two kids in The Nickel Boys, too, are very much defined by Jim Crow and the racist world around them. And so immediately, once I started writing Carney, I knew this is somebody who was going to win. You know, he was going to win sometimes. Not all the time, but he has a different sort of engagement with the forces around him. And maybe he's not as socially conscious, and maybe I don't find him admirable all the time, but I have great affection for him. And putting him in these different positions where he's tested was quite a lot of fun.
One of the ways he protects himself from thinking of himself as being a criminal is that he sees the goods, but he never sees the people who were robbed, or the businesses that were robbed. And if there's no victim that he knows about, it's less of a crime. It really made me think about how easy it must be to protect yourself from thinking about the victim if you don't know who the victim is. You don't know who's been hurt and how they've been hurt.
I think that's definitely true. I don't think I explored that enough in the book, so I'll take that. I'll write that down for future inquiry. Thank you. Thank you for that point. But also, you know, in each section in the book, you know, from 59 to 61 to 64, I keep pulling back, and we start with like a street-level view of crime in Harlem, and then we pull back and meet some well-to-do African-American bankers and insurance agents, sort of upper class of Harlem. And they're, you know, it turns out they're pretty crooked too. And a lot of their victims, they can't put faces to because they're signing paper, calling in mortgages on people they've never seen. And then in the third section, I pull back even more and we see more of the power structure in the city. We visit Park Avenue and Wall Street. And those guys on the 35th floor have no idea who they're harming in their machinations. And so, Carney is in a position where he doesn't get to see who's the actual victim of these crimes. And then there are people who are operating on a scale so much, of such a bigger magnitude.
You set the novel in Harlem. It's a black world in Harlem and in your novel, except for the cops who are white. Was it a relief to write about Harlem after writing about an escaped slave who runs into every imaginable problem after escaping?
I think doing Underground and Nickel Boys back-to-back definitely took its toll. I mean, I think I had done all my emotional heavy lifting before I wrote Underground Railroad, and so I knew what I was getting into. But then having another setting where innocents are being brutalized and are searching for their freedom really demoralized me. And so as I was finishing The Nickel Boys and bringing the boys closer to their tragic fate that I'd mapped out, you know, 2 years before, I definitely felt very depressed and depleted. And I finished the book and then just played video games and barbecued for 6 weeks. And that's how I came back into myself. So having a project that has the capacity for joking and humor. And I do see making jokes as part of my project and why I write. It's one of my, you know, avenues of exploration. So having fun with, you know, this crime genre and some of the supporting cast who are kind of colorful was a relief. And from the first page of writing the book and getting back into writing a book set in New York, I felt I was on my home turf after writing two books set in the South, and the challenge of recreating a New York before I appeared on the scene. I was born in 69, was a nice challenge to put before me.
Colson Whitehead, it's been really great to have you back on the show. And I want to say again, I really love your new book. So thank you.
Thanks for having me. It was great.
My interview with Colson Whitehead was recorded in September 2021 after the publication of his novel, Harlem Shuffle. Fresh Air Weekend was produced this week by Heidi Simon. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Teresa Madden, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Chaloner, Seth Kelly, and Kayla Lattimore. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nesper. I'm Terry Gross. All of us at Fresh Air wish you a healthy and fulfilling 2022.